All right, I think I'm live. I've never done this before, so I'm figuring this out as I go. Hi, for anyone who's here. My name is Dr. Mark Eatenson. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, licensed in the states of California and New York. I'm also a specialist in the treatment of pathological narcissism and related disorders, including NPD. I'm author of the book, Unmasking Narcissism, A Guide to Understanding the Narcissist in Your Life. The book's right up there over my shoulder. That's a hands-on guide to understanding the psychodynamics and the interpersonal dynamics of pathological narcissism and NPD, written from a compassionate and humanizing perspective. And it's available wherever fine books are sold. I can see. Okay, there are people here. There's 23 people here. Great. That's fantastic. Like I said, this is my first outing doing a live stream. I'm actually incredibly nervous. Hello, Uzair. I had nightmares last night that I would get in front of the camera, realize no one was here, realize I didn't have anything to talk about, and that the whole thing would just be a flaming disaster. So hopefully that won't happen, but I thought I'd share that with you in the interest of being vulnerable and accessible and just letting people know how I feel. My hope is that you'll have some good questions for me today and some comments. Oh my gosh, I see all these people. Wow, this is fantastic. I see Cluster B Milkshake. Hi. And a bunch of other people. Somebody from Madrid, Spain. Fantastic. Well, thank you all so much for showing up. I'm here to answer your questions. So feel free to leave them over in the chat. Okay. Somebody says that this started in the middle of me mentioning my book. I'll just really briefly introduce myself one more time then. My name is Dr. Mark Eatenson. I'm a licensed psychologist, and I specialize in the treatment of pathological narcissism and related disorders. Okay, so there's already a question. Am I familiar with narrative therapy, and do I see a parallel between a preferred identity and a false self? And it looks like Bill Lumberg himself asked that question. I have a passing familiarity with narrative therapy. I have not done narrative therapy myself, nor am I specifically trained in narrative therapy. I also haven't taught narrative therapy, but I do sort of know what it is and what it's about. I don't know specifically about a preferred identity, although I'm imagining that from within the narrative therapy framework. So for folks who aren't familiar with what that is, narrative therapy is sort of, you know, we all have this way, this story, right? A narrative that we construct about ourselves, about our lives, about what's happening. And those narratives guide the way that we attribute meaning to events, and those attributions that we make based on the narrative that we have are what drive, you know, our emotional reactions. They're what sort of tell us, you know, what's going on and what we should do about it. So if somebody has, you know, particularly sort of maladaptive or unhelpful narrative that they're kind of acting out of and conceptualizing experience through, they're going to be engaging in pathological behavior. And that's also going to contribute to things like mood disorders and anxiety disorders and stuff like that. So I'm imagining that, although I don't know for sure, that a preferred identity from within the frame of narrative therapy would be sort of, a preferred way of seeing oneself. I think that borders on what a false self is in psychoanalytic and psychodynamic models, although the false self is more deeply rooted, I think, in unconscious conflict. So it is a compensatory construct that is developed very early in life in order to defend against chronic experiences of rejection lapses in empathic attunement very early in life. So it's basically, you could think of it as the child's best attempt to be, or at least appear to be, the person that it seems that their caregivers need or want them to be. So having its roots very deeply in the unconscious, oftentimes folks who, you know, have a strong false self presentation, that they're not aware of it. And it's actually can be quite challenging in clinical work to engender insight, to help the patient get insight into that false self experience, and to begin to recognize it as not self. So I hope that answers your question, Lumberg 42. And thank you so much for asking it. Oh, I realized that I can show questions. Okay, fantastic. Let's see, I got somebody from Kenya here. That's great. Hi, thank you for joining. Okay, Roxy asks, is hypnotherapy useful for NPD? I don't know. It's a little bit of a wild frontier when it comes to treatment of NPD a little bit. A lot of people are trying out a lot of different approaches. There is not a wide consensus in the field about, you know, even how to best define narcissistic personality disorder, and there certainly isn't a consensus about how best to treat it. I would say that the leading approaches, as is typical, they're sort of manualized therapies, and all that means is that somebody took kind of a complex concept and distilled it down into discrete sort of steps that a clinician would take in treating the issue. So one of those is transference focused therapy, and the other one would be mentalization based therapy. Also, dialectical behavioral therapy is a popular approach that's being adapted. It was developed for borderline personality disorder, and it's being adapted for narcissistic personality disorder. You know, the thing about hypnotherapy is that there just isn't, to my knowledge, a really wide empirical, a strong empirical base for using hypnotherapy. Mostly, and I'm sure I'll get some flack for this, but mostly, when I've seen hypnotherapy used, it's been for things like smoking cessation and stuff like that. I wouldn't put a lot of stock in its ability to really make a substantial difference in something as kind of with roots as deep as a personality disorder. If you're thinking about looking at hypnotherapy or something like that, I would actually steer you in a different direction. I don't think you're not going to get the best bang for your buck pursuing hypnotherapy for NPD. But thank you so much for the question. Okay, Sarah Eva says, does inner child work help with NPD treatment? I guess I'm a... From my perspective, I think all psychotherapy is in a way inner child work. I know that you're speaking about a specific approach that would be more explicitly defined as, okay, now we're going to work on healing the inner child, talking to the inner child, conceptualizing the inner child and what that child's needs might be, what the pain they're holding might be, and sort of talking to that child explicitly. I think that's great. I don't have any issue with that. I don't tend to do it so much, but I do often reference when it feels relevant in the treatment. I think there's a part of you here that's very young, or I think there's a hurt child who's speaking. I can hear that part of you speaking when you talk about, whatever it is that the person's talking about. And I do invite patients to imagine that child and to imagine how they might comfort that child, because I do think that can be an incredibly impactful intervention. And I think perhaps most importantly, it engenders self-compassion, which the evidence shows is just so crucial for NPD. People with NPD, they don't have a realistic self-image. It's one of the defining characteristics, right? That the self-image is not realistic, it's not stable, and it's not positive, right? Basically positive. And we need all those three things to be true in order to have a healthy self-image, healthy self-esteem. And the core of NPD is faulty self-esteem management. And so I do think that helping somebody to create a more compassionate image of who they are and who they were, and how the ways that they were hurt when they were very young are showing up in their present day life and motivating some of the defenses and other issues that they're experiencing, can be incredibly helpful. Thank you for the question. Yeah, okay. So Terry asks, how would I approach a person with NPD to make them aware of their condition? You know, I don't have to worry about that so much anymore, because people, they seek me out, you know, already kind of being aware of, or at least somewhat aware of their condition. But earlier in my career, before I kind of got this reputation for being a specialist in this area, colleagues would refer narcissistic patients to me. And sometimes, you know, the patient would have no idea that that's why they were referred. And it would be up to me to find a way to sort of break that news to them. You know, I think the thing is, and I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, I can see real value to, you know, having a diagnosis, right? To the person, you know, having that label, that name to put to their experience, and that diagnosis can reinforce the need for treatment, right? Especially when, you know, they might go into maybe a more defended or grandiose phase of the disorder, in which there would be a tendency to minimize the need for treatment and for help and support and that sort of thing. So I think having that kind of like, no, I'm a diagnosed narcissist, can help a person kind of stay grounded in the need for treatment during those phases. On the other hand, I don't put a lot of stock in, you know, diagnosing. For the longest time in my career, I kind of didn't do it unless I had to, because, you know, insurance reimbursement or records release request or something like that. That's because I think in the field, there's a tendency to reify disorders. So, and what that means is just basically to say, well, you know, something like, you know, but I don't know, pick a disorder, right? Generalized anxiety disorder, that is sort of to feel like that is a disease in the same way that, you know, influenza is a disease, right? That you could locate, like, okay, this is the virus, this is the particle, this is the faulty brain circuit, this is the, you know, whatever it is that is biologically based that is driving this disorder. Okay, so that would be like reifying the disorder. Mental disorders, they're decided by committee, right? The American Psychiatric Association, they get together on a semi-regular basis. They review the literature, they look at the evidence, and they say, okay, what are we going to call this disorder, right? Where are we going to draw the lines around this syndrome, right? Okay, this syndrome, we feel like the evidence is substantial enough to call this a disorder, but this one over here, not so much. And that's a constant process of, you know, review and revision. I think it's much more helpful and important in a clinical setting to be making meaning of experience, so when I give patients feedback, I'm talking to them about, you know, I'm trying to use experience near terminology to talk about what they're actually experiencing, and only every so often, if it feels like it might be helpful, am I connecting that to some conceptual, you know, explicitly like conceptual framework, like this is that diagnosis, or this is this diagnosis. So anyway, that's from a clinical perspective. If you're just talking about somebody in your life and that you think might have NPD, the way that I would talk to them about this is in terms of self-esteem and emotional insight. And, if they seem like areas in their life where it seems like there may be deficits or disabilities, and ways that they might be compensating for those that aren't so helpful. So I don't think you actually need to use the word narcissism or NPD at all. In fact, I would probably advise against it just because it's so stigmatized in our culture. But I think it's perfectly valid to talk to somebody about their self-esteem, about how it seems hard for them to ask for help or support, about how you notice that sometimes it seems like they're actually feeling insecure, but maybe they're not even aware of it, stuff like that. And always just leaving space for disagreement and, you know, for the fact that you don't actually know what's going on inside of them. And I think that's just good practice across the board. People have to want treatment, and nobody's going to go for treatment if they don't recognize that there's an issue. And that can be incredibly difficult. And typically, you know, you're not going to be the one who convinces them that there's an issue. Typically, it's going to be kind of like circumstances conspiring, you know, coming together to overwhelm whatever defensive, you know, matrix they have going on. And then there's something like a collapse, and then they might be open to seeking help. And those kinds of collapses, they can happen for some people, you know, just once a decade. And for other people, they happen multiple times a day. And that's just the variation in this disorder. So I hope that's helpful. And thank you so much for the question. All right. So we got Reg here asking if I've thought about the use of psychedelics and treatment of pathological narcissism. I have. And I've actually had patients who used psychedelics and experimented with psychedelics and to mixed results. One patient in particular was using psychedelics, and I would have to say they helped. I'd have to say they were beneficial for that patient. Others, you know, not so much. There's such wide individual variation in this disorder. You know, for the person that it helped, the way that it helped was that it brought them closer to internal experiences against which they were heavily defended. And it allowed them to create sort of more space inside of themselves for those parts of them, those vulnerable parts, those insecure parts, those ashamed parts, to coexist with, you know, the maybe more grandiose or compensatory self-image, that made a huge difference. I think it's absolutely possible to get there without psychedelics. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a medical doctor. This is not me saying, "Hey, kids, go do drugs." This is just me saying, in my experience, I've seen it go both ways, and I think there's a case to be made for in some people a beneficial effect. I think there's also a case to be made, you know, that in some people it would make things worse. Psychedelics, they kind of degrade your experience of reality, right? And reality and fantasy become profoundly merged when you're on psychedelics, depending on the dose and et cetera. And for some people that would be a bad thing, especially folks who are already having trouble kind of dealing with, you know, what's real and what isn't. So thank you so much for the question. All right, Joshua says, what's the difference between superficial charm and real charm in association with narcissism, and is the distinction observed in my clinical practice? Yeah. I have to think about this for just a second. There's kind of a way that I feel like charm is charm, and somebody who's charming is charming. I think that there can be a kind of charm that is about expressing authentic feelings and you know, interpersonal desires, right? So people can be incredibly charming and vulnerable at the same time, or, you know, I mean, and that's just kind of a gift that some people have, I feel like. The false self presentation that's common in narcissism will include some element of superficial charm. And that's the idea there is to, well, it's overdetermined. So there's on the one hand, it's about trying to defensively minimize, you know, any perceived flaws, right? So, you know, somebody who's kind of charming and funny and witty and whatever, you know, life of the party. Well, they're feeling less vulnerable. They're feeling less exposed. And that experience, right? So if they're able to be charming and kind of likable, then other people are going to respond, you know, by liking them and by providing positive mirroring. And then the person is able to use that positive mirroring in the service of kind of propping up and fortifying that false self image. When I'm talking about false self, we could also be calling it kind of a defensive positive self image or a defensive grandiose self image. Basically, it's that the person feels so collapsed and so chaotic and so empty on the inside that there is this kind of edifice that's constructed, this armor that's constructed on top of it. And that's sort of where they try to stay. But that armor needs to be constantly reinforced because there's always that underlying dysphoric experience that's degrading that armor and threatening to pull them down into the sort of empty or fragmenting experience that's underneath of it. And so the person is constantly trying to convince themselves and convince other people that, no, this is who I really am, you know, and charm works in the service of that. And I see that in my practice all the time. And, you know, what I do with it is I basically just sit with it when I see it. I try not to gratify the desire or the pull, you know, to positively mirror that false self presentation. But I also try not to go under it because that never works. I try not to kind of, you know, like try to pull the person into like, cause that would feel almost sadistic, right? Like, you're miserable. Like, look, see, instead, just sit with it, you know? And I try to validate the authenticity that's behind it. Which is, you know, that the person really kind of feels that they need to be the best. They need to be charming. They need to be shiny and perfect and idealized in order to be any kind of a self at all. And that's actually, I try to stay grounded in the tragedy of that and see the superficial charm through that lens. And when I do that, I find that kind of however I sit with the superficial charm tends to be therapeutic, as long as you try to stay connected to the authentic person who's underneath that. So thank you so much for the question, Joshua. Have I read Nathan Brandon's Six Pillars of Self-Esteem? I've not, but I'm wondering if you recommend it. And, you know, if so, I'd be interested in checking it out. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Battle Pass of the Fortnite. Hey, Dr. Eatonson. Hey. Just checking in. Have you watched Breaking Bad before? And if so, is there a potential NPD diagnosis for Walter White? Many have said that is the case. Though I do not think so. Really? You don't think so? Well, I've watched Breaking Bad in its entirety. And I've also watched Better Call Saul. And I think both are just phenomenal. But I do think that Walter White is a narcissistic character. In fact, that is an example that I use when I do clinical training. So every once in a while I'll do clinical trainings for clinicians about how to conceptualize and treat pathological narcissism. And when I talk about different presentations of pathological narcissism, I use Walter White as an example of covert grandiosity So, you know, and I don't want to give any spoilers away. If you haven't seen Breaking Bad, go watch it. It's spectacular. But in the beginning of Breaking Bad, he is this kind of unassuming high school chemistry teacher, right? But the first few episodes give you a glimpse into the covert grandiosity that's kind of seething and raging under the surface, right? That he feels that he was cheated out of his fortune and glory by his colleagues, that he resents his kind of mild-mannered existence, that he feels that he's deserves and is entitled to a much broader impact on the world. And there's also a kind of narcissistic rage that goes along with that, that comes out periodically throughout the series. So, I think that Walter White is a fantastic example of a particular narcissistic constellation. Thank you so much for the question. Okay, 1-2. Isn't the basic issue with mental disorders like NPD is fear and how it is how fear is handled, if at all, or if someone simply freezes? The freezing in the face of fear is the worst. I think that one of the central experiences in NPD, whether it's conscious or unconscious, is attachment avoidance, because there's kind of a crippling fear that if the person gets too close to other people, that they will be exposed to intolerable rejection and the feeling of shame and humiliation. And so I do think that fear in the form of that anxiety is a central facet of pathological narcissism. The way that that fear is handled in the form of typically a dismissing, avoidant attachment style, or possibly a fearful, avoidant attachment style. Either way, the person has a tendency to minimize their need for emotional intimacy, for closeness, for attachment. And anytime somebody brings their own need for attachment to that person, there's a tendency to defensively dismiss that the validity of that person's feelings. And that shows up in the form of what most people would call impaired empathy. And I think that's valid. But I think that impaired empathy is often really about attachment avoidance, which is based on fear. So thank you for the question. John J. Gillen is asking if I see NPD as someone with a disorder of the self, like James Masterson, who were never able to bring together a constituted sense of self, and if so, how to create a constituted sense of self. So, yeah, I think NPD is a disorder of the self. I tend to look at it through a combination of lenses. One of them is object relations theory. One of them is self-psychology, and the third would be the contemporary relational model in psychoanalysis. All of those are just kind of looking at different ways that the damage done by chronic relational trauma to the self emerges in the form of narcissistic pathology. So, you know, I think I don't look at it so much as a constituted sense of self, but more as kind of a lack of a individuated sense of self. And an attempt to compensate for that. And by individuated, I mean, you know, we all emerge right from this kind of fusion between self and other, right? So over time, during the first few years of life, you know, we kind of separate out these mutually dependent co-originating constructs of self and other, right? And those have a lot to do with each other always and necessarily, right? So what isn't self is by definition other, and what isn't other is by definition self. And the qualities of the self inform necessarily the qualities of the experience of other people. And when somebody has not been able to kind of create two distinct, differentiated constructs of self and others, but rather they're still kind of fused together, I think that, that's a recipe for all kinds of trouble. And you know, that involves profound boundary confusions, the presence of what we would call primitive introjects, which is sort of like the feeling that someone else is somehow intrusively or invasively a part of you, you know, the need to rely on how other people seem to experience you in order to constitute sort of a sense of self. So I think there are lots of different ways to conceptualize a self and self experience. And, you know, that this goes all the way back to, you know, Freud, essentially, and his notion of the ego, right? Mm-hmm. So without getting too like technical and stuff like that, that's my answer. Thank you for the question. Let's see. So XX is asking me, is it necessary for people to know they have NPD in order to heal? And can they conceptualize their struggles as childhood emotional neglect, people pleasing, or perfectionism and still heal? Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's any magic in the label of NPD. I think, you know, I essentially see psychotherapy as a form of reparenting. And so, you know, either way, whether we call it NPD or we don't, we're still dealing with very early parts of the self and their strivings. On top of that, we're dealing with the layers of defenses and affect that have been built on top of that kind of wounded core. I think we can heal that wounded core without calling it NPD, and that works too. Yeah. So thank you. Peanuts asking, what are the outcomes that I've seen in terms of recovery from NPD, and how much of a recovery have I observed? What do I think is a realistic outcome? I've seen lots of different outcomes. I have seen NPD remit. I've seen patients who I would diagnose with NPD, and I would no longer diagnose them with NPD. As I've stated in some of my videos, though, you know, we all have like one or more dominant personality styles, and those personality styles are defined by our core conflicts, and those core conflicts are based on early experience in combination with genetics and temperament and whatever else, right? And so those conflicts, they sit at the core of who we are, and they motivate the defensive adaptations that we develop that we would call personality. Right. I use different references for what those personality styles might be. When I do diagnostic assessments for NPD, I use an assessment instrument that is based on, you know, kind of a model of those different personality styles or prototypes or syndromes. But syndromes is a bad name because it's possible to have, and this is the point I'm trying to make, it's possible to have a narcissistic personality style where your core concerns in life are about self-worth and self-efficacy. And for you not to be pathological. It's possible for you to be a perfectly healthy individual who just happens to be motivated by some insecurities about whether or not you're good enough. And I think we see that a lot, that particular personality style, like when we watch the Academy Awards, you know, like I think that there's a way that personality style tends toward performance and tends toward, you know, trying to be larger than life, to get seen, to get validated. But that's not necessarily intrinsically pathological. I think that when it becomes pathological is when those concerns are so big and so central, and they take up so much space inside that they derail the person's life, and they start getting in the way of holding a job, of having mutually satisfying relationships, of having realistic, stable, and positive self-esteem. When that's happening, that's when we start, when we would call it pathological narcissism. And when that is so, when that's taking up so much space in the person that their whole world revolves around it, that's when we call it NPD. So when somebody has NPD, the goals that I have in mind is to increase their ability to tolerate the ebbs and flows of positive and negative self-esteem, increase their capacity to have a realistic self-image, and through the use of, you know, kind of the therapeutic relationship over time, to help build a more stable internal foundation, such that the self-esteem isn't fluctuating so widely. And so there's more stability of self-esteem. So basically to lessen the amount of distress that is experienced by the person, and with lower distress and greater stability, you're going to have fewer problems, and that personality disorder is going to shrink down to something that's more manageable. Maybe it only shows up in a few places in their life, or maybe only when they're really triggered or really overwhelmed or something like that. And at that point, we would say, oh, well, there's not a personality disorder anymore. Now it's just a kind of a circumscribed issue. And, you know, they can stay in therapy and keep working on it. And I often recommend that they do. How often does that happen? Well, that's hard work, right? There's a book I've got on my shelf here. Let's see. Yeah. Okay. Characterological Transformation, The Hard Work Miracle. This is by Stephen Johnson. Highly recommend Stephen Johnson. Love his stuff. He's also got another book called Humanizing the Narcissistic Style. I don't know if you could hear that. I wasn't looking at the camera. Humanizing the Narcissistic Style. Stephen Johnson. He's one of my heroes. Highly, highly recommend it. It's clinical stuff. It's written for clinicians, but it is good stuff. And, you know, he calls that kind of transformation the hard work miracle, right? So it's not easy. It takes a long time. It takes commitment and dedication, but it is absolutely possible. So I hope that answers your question. Let's see. Good question. Okay. T. Wells is asking, do people with NPD have a true self? I've seen the work of a certain professor. is that Vaknin? I'm not sure. Well-known on YouTube who says they don't. It's so disheartening, and it keeps me stuck in hopelessness. Well, yes, there is a true self. Okay. So what is it? What does it even mean? Here's the problem. And I responded to a YouTube comment on another video this morning to this effect. The person was basically saying, well, there's no true self to heal, so healing's impossible, right? And that's a philosophical debate, you know. Is there a true self or isn't there a true self? Well, I don't know, and neither does anybody else. And there's really no way to verify that empirically. I mean, we might as well ask how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. You know, I don't know. Right. And furthermore, it's not my place to posit, you know, whether or not a person has an authentic self or a true self versus this false self. But I think that they necessarily have to have a true self. Whatever it is that's under the false self presentation and that maintains the need for a false self presentation, I would call an authentic self. And that can be rooted in biology. It can be so deeply unconscious that it's just rooted in biology, right? And Bessel van der Kolk, you know, his book, The Body Keeps the Score, talks about this a little bit. But basically, he's talking about embodied trauma, right? Trauma that can't be processed up here, but it's felt in here somewhere. It's upset stomach, or it's, you know, whatever it is, right? That is an authentic experience, right? It's just encoded at the level of the somatic. But there are also people, you know, whose false self defenses crumble and collapse into distress, despair, rage, you know, you name it, on a fairly regular basis. And I would call all of those authentic experiences too, right? Anything that isn't compensatory and that isn't designed to put out this kind of self-sufficient facade is, to my mind, authentic experience. And the goal of the work that I do in therapy is to try to increase the person's access to those authentic thoughts and feelings and experiences, and to help them recognize that those are rooted in what's real and what's true for them. So joy and sorrow, right? And often I find that the easiest route to authentic experience is grief. So going into whatever is there that's painful, I feel like that is typically authentic. So that's my answer. Gosh, I'm so sorry to read that you're feeling disheartened and hopeless. I don't think you need to feel that way. I don't. I think that it can certainly seem hopeless, and especially if you like look on YouTube for more than 10 minutes, you know, yeah, that's a bleak landscape. But in my experience, the authenticity is absolutely there, 100%. And it is also typically accessible. Although there are some heavily defended presentations where the grandiosity is fused with a kind of sadism and a kind of psychopathy and a kind of aggression. We would call that malignant narcissism. And that presentation, that's a tougher nut to crack. No pun intended. I realize that could be, I'm not calling people nuts, just using the idiomatic expression, but anyway, that's a harder problem to solve. And that's because the experience of vulnerability is quickly short-circuited, and turned into sadistic aggression. I would say that's a less positive prognosis. Again, not hopeless. If any time there is buy-in and the person wants to get better, I believe firmly, with 100% of my being, that it is possible to heal. Okay, I was wondering if I could talk about, Jennifer says, I was wondering if I could talk about what to expect as a person with NPD ages, gets into their 70s and beyond. Does NPD behavior change with age? Yeah, I was just reading a thing about this today. Let me see if I can find it. Longitudinal course. Okay, here we go. Let's see. Okay. Yeah. Longitudinal course. And now that I moved, I resized my window and I lost it. Hold on one sec. Okay. So this is taken from an article in Focus, the Lifelong Journal of Learning in Psychiatry. Elsa Roningstam and Igor Weinberg are the authors. It appeared in 2022. Okay. And they say, that overall, studies have documented the persistence of narcissistic pathology, even among patients who improve symptomatically. Okay, so by the way, this is without treatment, right? This is just kind of what happens as a person gets older. Patients with the disorder tend to improve slowly and gradually, and rapid improvements have not been documented. Studies have used categorical diagnosis of the disorder and tended to... studies that have used categorical diagnosis of the disorder have tended to document symptomatic improvements, whereas studies that relied on dimensional measures have tended to demonstrate stability. Okay. What they're saying is it's in part how you conceptualize the disorder. But they're also saying here, if there is paranoid thinking, antisocial traits, and egosyntonic aggression, so kind of what I was just describing in response to the other question, those things impede improvement. Other things like history of adversity, employment, or interpersonal functioning have not been tested. And they've got sort of a chart here, and they're saying, you know, according to these different studies, here's what they've found. The one that has the oldest population is ages 18 to 60. That's Durbin and Klein, published in 2006. And they say that there's a stable course in the disorder. So it really doesn't get better as a person ages without intervention. Okay. So that's just one study. But, you know, that's what the empirical literature suggests. So thank you for your question. Oh my gosh, there's so many questions. I'm only like 6 minutes in to the questions. I'm going to have to do this again. But I'm overwhelmed by how many people have showed up and how many questions you have. So thank you. Let's see. Thank you, Crispin. I'll take the compliment. Thanks. I'm doing well. Let's see. How do you know if a narcissist is willing? Well, they go to therapy. Uzair, since the range of behaviors of someone with NPD may fluctuate between, let's say, NPD, BPD, and HPD, and paranoid, avoidant, etc., isn't it more accurate to look at someone with NPD as someone with BPO instead? BPO, I'm assuming, means borderline personality organization. Yeah, I do. In fact, anytime a person has a personality disorder, I'm immediately thinking them as borderline personality organization. And for anybody who doesn't know what that means, one way of conceptualizing personality is to look at it on a developmental continuum. Okay, where at the bottom, you've got something called psychotic organization. And at the top, you've got healthy personality organization. And in between psychotic and healthy, you've got borderline, and then you've got neurotic. Each of those is defined by a part of the personality that is not totally developed. Okay, so in the psychotic organization, you're talking about somebody whose kind of ego capacities are so underdeveloped that even kind of dealing with the distinction between reality and fantasy is problematic. That doesn't mean they have schizophrenia now. This is kind of like a way of gauging the severity of a personality organization. Somebody who's got the borderline personality organization, okay, they're on the border between psychotic and neurotic, okay, because when psychoanalytic theories were first being developed, you know, everything was neurotic or psychotic, right? Neurotic, it means that they've sort of successfully navigated the Oedipal conflict in Freudian terms, but in more contemporary terms, neurotic means that they are capable of having what are called whole object relationships. So that means that, remember earlier I was talking about how the self and the object kind of separate into these distinct constructs that are still mutually dependent, but distinct inside the person. That when a person does that, that's the neurotic personality organization. There's a clear sense of self, and there's a clear sense of other people, and they're not kind of blended together in this kind of soupy mix that gets really confusing for the person. For somebody at the borderline level, that's when their self and other are still kind of enmeshed, okay? And that results in very problematic ways of thinking, feeling, and relating, because the distinction between self and other is not clear. And so they tend to rely on problematic defenses like projection, projective identification, splitting, acting out, stuff like that. Okay, so, and that, and those are the kinds of defenses that tend to define personality disorders across the board. And so, yeah, I think of borderline personality organization. That's my primary thought when I'm working with somebody who has a personality disorder. But not all people have NPD, right? There are pathological narcissism presentations that I wouldn't put in the borderline range. I would see them as kind of hovering in the neurotic, low neurotic to very high borderline range, but maybe most of the time in that kind of low neurotic range. And so I don't think that looking at it in terms of BPO is more helpful in those instances. I also think that there's something to be said for, okay, so broadly speaking, the personality is organized in a certain, you know, stratus of, you know, development, right? But each personality disorder is defined by central characteristics, central ways of defending against central issues that define that particular personality disorder. And so I think that it's helpful to retain the idea of NPD for that reason as well. Thank you so much for the question. Let's see. Do I know anything about how to treat HPD, histrionic personality disorder, or any experts you know focused on how to treat HPD? I don't know any experts focused on that. I think by and large, when we're talking about cluster B personality disorders, with the exception of antisocial personality disorder, the treatment approach is going to be similar. And that's why, you know, things like DBT and MBT are being adapted. It originally developed for borderline, but being adapted for NPD. And I think the same goes for HPD as well. I have treated patients with HPD. There's just some different things to watch out for, different, you know, countertransference pulls in the treatment relationship. Tend to rely on slightly different characteristic defenses, but I think by and large, cluster B personality disorders, again, with the exception of antisocial, are about a wounded and or fragmenting experience of self and confusion between self and others. And they tend to be acted out. They tend to externalize that conflict and act it out in their close relationships. Are all vulnerable narcissists introverts? This is from our divine mouse overlord, who looks like he's, I don't want to piss this guy off. he's holding a cleaver. But are they all introverts, or have I met exceptions? Okay, so this is a great question. First of all, the idea that there are vulnerable narcissists and grandiose narcissists, I think, is misleading. I think that all narcissistic presentations involve kind of a smush of grandiose and vulnerable aspects. But that being said, some configurations are more prone to narcissistic collapse than others, and we could call that vulnerable narcissism. But I don't think that they're necessarily introverts. I think that a person can be extroverted and also vulnerable. What really makes the distinction between vulnerable and grandiose kind of phenotypes is the ease with which the grandiose defenses crumble into the fragmenting self-experience underneath. Let's see. Are they looking to create new therapies for NPD? I would say yes. Transference focused psychotherapy is a good example of that. That's developed by Otto Kernberg, and he's famous for, you know, the famous object relations theorist and clinician. And his whole career is about NPD. And so he developed TFP specifically, for NPD, essentially. Let's see. Many of the concepts and ideas I present sound applicable to many forms of personality disorder or childhood trauma. What makes NPD treatment specific in comparison? Yeah, well, that's because they are. Again, it's this, and this gets into the previous question about borderline personality organization. The personality disorders are remarkably similar in many respects. And this is one of the reasons why, I'm always online, in my videos being like, well, this is a mental illness, right? There's nothing fundamentally different about people with NPD that sets them apart as incurable or untreatable or the devil incarnate or whatever it is, right, that the kind of stigma is suggesting. Personality disorders are personality disorders, and they tend to, have very similar central deficits and then some characteristic ways of compensating for those deficits. And NPD, the deficit is about self-esteem. And the characteristic way of compensating has to do with a grandiose false self or a compensatory positive model of self that's developed and that then is prone to collapse, exposing the person to those central deficits. Okay, Oren considers NPD a manifestation of CPTSD. That's complex post-traumatic stress disorder. That's an up-and-coming way of conceptualizing trauma. I happen to agree. I do think that NPD, as well as most personality disorders, are manifestations of CPTSD. Any substantial success in healing by I'm not sure what SE is. But EMDR, that's eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, mindfulness, et cetera. I think mindfulness is great. I think mindfulness is, I recommend it to my patients. I think that that's a great way to develop self-compassion. It's a great way to increase your ability to tolerate distressed states without acting them out. It's a great way to increase your insight and your empathy. EMDR, I don't know much about EMDR. It's not something I've ever really looked at very closely. I might get this wrong, but I went to a training once and they were talking about EMDR, and I remember the kind of the takeaway of it was that EMDR is great for discrete traumatic events, but it's maybe not so great for chronic or complex trauma. And so I don't know if that's true or not. It might not be, but that was the takeaway at one training that I attended. So if I'm wrong about that, I apologize. All the people out there who have benefited from EMDR or practice it. Anyway, thanks for the question. Lumberg is asking, is there a notion of things as mirrors instead of people as mirrors? Yes. Yeah. So what we're really talking about is self-object experiences. Self-object experiences are any experience that's used to shore up, reconstitute, or define the experience of self. When we're very young, self-object experiences tend to be more about, other people, right? They tend to be like, I idealize dad and dad is a self-object to me. And so, therefore I'm great too. Or, I remember when I was a kid, I wanted to be Indiana Jones and Superman, right? Those were my idealizations because I was a kid in the 80s. And so those were self-objects for me, right? And the qualities of Superman, I took those in as interjects and they became in some way, central facets of who I was at that particular point in time. Luke Skywalker was another one. But as we get older, right, our self-object experiences, they tend to be less concrete and tangible and more abstract, right? So now, you know, my self-object experience, it isn't Superman, right? Or Indiana Jones or Luke Skywalker. It's, you know, my profession is a self-object experience for me, right? It helps define who I am. My role in my family, my role in my community, right? Those kinds of things. My identity as a citizen of the United States, things like that. So those are kind of age-appropriate self-object experiences. When a person experiences a lot of trauma, a lot of developmental, you know, interruption and stuff like that, when they're very young, they tend to persist in the use of those tangible, concrete self-objects, and they tend to be inflexible about it. So I need you to see me this way in order for me to feel like a good person. And if it seems like you don't see me this way, right in between these two, right? If you're over here, now you're a bad object. Get, you know, and then there's a whole thing about that. So that would be an age inappropriate self-object. Using other people as self-objects is age inappropriate when we reach adulthood. But somebody who's kind of in an inflexible space where they're really reliant on concrete self-object experiences for self-esteem, yeah, they might see a dirty kitchen sink as that could cause a collapse, right? That's 100% possible. So thank you for that question. Let's see. Ribbon Spice, do I have advice for writing characters with NPD empathetically? Stay close to the central wound, and to the empty or fragmenting self that's underneath the grandiosity. So let's see. At peace with not knowing, what can a close friend or partner of someone with NPD do to support them in a vulnerable state? Just be there, but in a well-boundaried way. So my videos, I often talk about the importance of boundaries, right? It is possible to be kind and to be empathetic and also to have boundaries. So anytime you're dealing with somebody who's got any personality disorder or any kind of really provocative interpersonal presentation, boundaries are going to be key. Be very clear for yourself where your boundaries are and hold those boundaries. Because the nature of personality disorders especially is to pull people out of their kind of, pull people into violating their own boundaries. Because the person with the personality disorder, their boundaries are kind of non-existent, right? Because the self is not completely emerged from the object. So you got this kind of self-object, object fusion happening. And so they will pull into enactments that violate your own boundaries. So it's very important to have firm boundaries, but also to be kind and supportive. That looks different for each situation. But I think those are that would be the guiding principle. I guess I would say you want to validate without gratifying. The person, if they're in crisis, they want gratification, right? I have a need, meet it immediately, right? The pressure behind my need is so great that I need for you to meet it right here, right now. And often, in order to meet that need, you would have to violate a boundary, one of your own boundaries. And so hold the boundary, validate the feeling of crisis or pressure or emergency behind what they're saying, but don't gratify what they're asking for if it violates your boundary. Okay. Gosh, guys, I'm getting a little tired here, but I'm interested in continuing, maybe until about 3:30, if possible. So I'm not gonna keep answering every question because I think there's a lot of questions. But I'm gonna look and see if I can pull out ones that might be more broadly applicable. Okay, why do people with NPD keep repeating the same patterns of behavior and never learn from their mistakes over and over again? Low insight. That's essentially what it is. That and splitting. So splitting is, best way to think about splitting is this. Imagine an archipelago, okay, like Hawaii. Okay, so the Hawaiian Islands look like separate islands from the surface of the ocean. If you go underneath the ocean, you see that they're all connected. They're all part of the same mountain chain, right? And these are just the peaks of these mountains sticking up above the surface of the water. But if you don't go underwater, you just see separate islands, okay? So what psychology is learning is that none of us have kind of like a unipolar self, okay? There's no sort of central, stable construct that is self. What we really have are multiple selves. And ideally, those multiple selves are well integrated. The lines of communication between them are robust. And the transition between these different self states is smooth and not disruptive to the person's functioning and to their relationships, okay? So you can think about these as centers of emotional gravity. You could think about these as different ways that the self has come to be defined in relation to an experience of other, right? So there's a self for me that's kind of defined in relation to my mother. There's a self for me that's defined in relation to my father. There's one that's defined in relation to my best friend in grade school, to my second grade teacher, to my boss, to my spouse, to my, you know, right? Okay, so all these different selves that are defined in relation to all these different experiences of other people. Ideally, the difference between all those is mild. It's there's not huge stark differences. And where there are stark differences, there's a lot of communication between all the other parts, right? Okay. What can happen in especially personality disorders is that all those different self states become like separate islands of experience, where the communication is poor between them, where a storm happening on one of them, you know, isn't, storm can be happening on one of them, but not on another one. Each has their own distinct ecosystem, right? Okay, so this, I'm starting to kind of wear out the metaphor, but basically these separations between these self states are reinforced via dissociation and trauma, okay? So it prevents the person from integrating all these different parts of themselves, all these different centers of emotional gravity. And what you end up with are siloed, you know, parts of the self. And so when the person is on, you know, Maui, right, it has nothing to do with what's going on Oahu. Or when they're in one silo, it has nothing to do with what's in the other silo, okay? And so the transition between those different self states can be incredibly abrupt. And typically when the transition happens, there's very little memory of what it was like in the other self state, right? Because again, the lines of communication between them are disrupted via dissociative phenomena. And so we call this splitting, all right? So when a person is splitting, it's not just that they see you through a different lens, okay? They are a different self experiencing you differently than the self that was experiencing you 5 minutes before or last year or whatever. And all of reality is rewritten according to this new center of emotional, experiential, and relational gravity. And so this is why the behavior of people with personality disorders seems so inconsistent and confusing, and why one day they're like, oh my gosh, you're right, I've got a problem and I need help, thank you, how can I get help? And then the next day they're like, screw you, what are you talking about, I never said that, right? That that has to do with splitting and the disruption of the continuity of internal experience that is part and parcel to personality disorders. And so that's another reason why a person can repeat the same mistakes over and over and over again in their life and never seem to benefit from any insight, because those mistakes are siloed, you know, in one kind of self experience, and the other self experiences don't have access to it. This is different than dissociative identity disorder. I'm not talking about multiple personalities here, although I would say dissociative identity disorder is a very, very extreme form of splitting. But this is something that many people with multiple personality disorders experience. It's kind of, the term would be pathognomonic, or, you know, characteristic of borderline personality disorder in particular, but also narcissistic personality disorder splitting. So that's the answer. Thanks for the question. Cooper is asking, am I using a fancy camera, mic lighting, or something simple? And do I edit my videos myself? Do I teach myself about the technology I'm using, or does someone do it for you? Well, that depends on whether you think things look good or not. No. So this is just me. Right now I'm using a Logitech webcam. I'm mounted on a tripod in front of my computer monitor. And I've got two ring lights that light me. And then when I make my videos, I use the Sony ZV-E10 camera. And I feel like it's got pretty good results, although it's a steep learning curve, how to use the camera. I had to watch a few YouTube videos to teach me how to do that. I do edit all my videos myself. I use something called Movavi, which is like a software suite. It's less involved than like the Adobe products or something like DaVinci or something like that. I tried using both of those and I was so quickly overwhelmed that I just stuck with Movavi. It's fairly simple and straightforward. And once you get the hang of, you know, how to do the cuts and stuff like that, it goes pretty quickly. I hope to grow big enough as a channel that I can outsource video editing, because it takes up a lot of time. But for now, I'm a one man operation. Everything is done by me. And I teach myself to do it watching videos on YouTube. So thanks for the question. Let's see. Oh. What does it mean when NPD is said to have a schizoid core? Okay, so getting back to my man, Steven Johnson. He has these great names for different personality styles, okay? So he calls narcissism, and I've said this before in some of my videos, he calls NPD or narcissism the used child, okay? And what he's saying there is that the experience, the early attachment experiences in narcissism, they have to do with a kind of exploitative care, where the child feels that they have to be some other version of themselves in order to deserve love. And that's the genesis of the false self and the grandiosity and interpersonal inflexibility that people with NPD tend to exhibit. So that's the used child. Johnson calls the schizoid experience the hated child. And that's because these schizoid experiences is dominated by rejection and overwhelm, and the person has to go inside in order to escape an object world that seems filled with hurtful objects, hurtful caregivers. I think that NPD and schizoid organizations, they tend to go hand in hand. Not all the time, though. I don't think that NPD has a schizoid core, but I think that the sorts of relational experiences early on that tend to generate the schizoid versus the narcissistic experience, they can be similar. So, thank you. Let's see. Brandon says he's late, but thanks for joining us nonetheless. Brandon comments quite a bit on my videos, and his comments are always well-informed. And so I appreciate you being here. Let's see. Do I know if ketamine infusion therapy can aid with self-abandonment? I'm not sure what that means. And I don't know much about ketamine therapy, although there is another Mark Eatonson who lives in Florida who specializes in ketamine therapy for treatment-resistant depression. And he's a psychiatrist. Anyway, he might have the answer. The other Mark Eatonson might know the answer to this question. And there's no relation that I'm aware of, by the way. I mean, there probably is somewhere way back when, but none immediate. Let's see. What Uzair asks, why do they find it easier constantly seeking sources of admiration from new people? Isn't that more exhausting? Well, it's because that new person isn't sullied by disappointing experience, right? So when somebody's doing a particular version of splitting where they're idealizing other people, they are constantly in search of shiny new objects to idealize, because the more they get to know, the more experience they generate with that idealized other person, the harder it gets to continue idealizing them, because little disappointments and frustrations start to build up until eventually there's a kind of critical mass reached and the idealizations invert and turn to devaluations. And that, you know, so pop psychology would call that the love bombing and discard cycle. It's based on splitting, though, not some kind of like, you know, nefarious manipulation or whatever. But that's why there's a constant search for novel objects to idealize. And because the person is seeking to prop up the false self experience via association with idealized others. And so if the other person can no longer be idealized, that jeopardizes the stability of the false self. And so they got to find somebody else to idealize. I want to emphasize, none of this is like premeditated, right? It's not like the person is like, uh-oh, you know, the clock on my idealizations is running out. I better go find myself a new object to love bomb. And none of that's happening. I don't know if anybody out there thinks that's happening. It certainly seems like some people think that's happening, and it certainly seems like some people are basing like their whole career off of that idea that that's what's happening, but that's not what's happening, at least not if we're talking about pathological narcissism, like the mental illness of it. Maybe we're talking about like somebody who's just kind of a jerk or whatever, and maybe they're out there doing that, but that's not NPD. So, what else do we have? Let's... Goodness gracious, there's so many questions. I'm overwhelmed by how many of you showed up and how many questions there are here. It's just, I wish that I could spend 5 hours and answer every single one. Okay, here's a good one. A lot of good questions, Uzair. How do I explain inability to mend amoralistic behaviors, especially with respect to crossing boundaries, greed, lying, exploiting, vulnerability for money, services, attention, and admiration? Okay, so basically, like the unrepentant, you know, aspects of some NPD presentations. So I think that amorality can go hand in hand with grandiosity. It's not that the person doesn't know what's right and wrong, because that's, they, you know, they might know what the difference between right and wrong, but I think often there's the lack of a strong intrinsic moral compass, because that would be based on a strong set of values, and a strong set of values is based typically, unless it's some kind of crazy inflexible radical thing, but a strong set of values is typically firmly rooted in a sense of self. And so, you know, if there is not a strong, stable sense of self, then there's going to be, that's going to affect a person's moral compass. And they're going to be more easily kind of blown around by the affective forces inside of them. So they're going to be pushed by pressures inside toward all kinds of things, impulsivity, ways of acting out their insecurities, ways of getting immediate needs met, idealizations and devaluations, all that kind of stuff. So they're just kind of like blown around, right, by these things. And as a result, they often, you know, result in, you know, criminal behavior, boundary violating behavior, insensitive behavior, stuff like that. Okay, so that's how that happens. But now if you try to hold somebody accountable for their actions, that kind of those silo self experiences I was talking about earlier, that's when they come into play. Okay, so when the person was acting out in that way, they might have been over here in this silo. And now when you're talking to them about it later, they're over here in this silo, right? And so there's a tendency to rationalize the things that they did before so that the justification matches the thoughts and feelings that are available in this silo. See, they don't have access to what's over here in this silo, right, anymore, because of splitting. And so there's a tendency to kind of make things up, right? And they don't realize they're making things up. They might think they're telling you the truth because the reasons they're giving now are consistent with how they would think and act in this self state, but they did the thing they did in another self state. And so that's the confusing piece about splitting, is that you get all kinds of like really inconsistent behaviors and then kind of post hoc rationalizations for those behaviors that don't make any sense, but they do to the person telling you. And you're like, this person's clearly a liar, right? And they must be manipulating me. And that's not necessarily true. They may not know that they're lying, and they may only be manipulating you in the loosest sense of the term, in that the personality disorder typically involves, you know, interpersonal manipulation and emotionally coercive behavior, but not like studied manipulation. Typically, it's more like just behaving toward people in a way that kind of pulls them into providing the kinds of self-object experiences that the narcissist needs to sustain the false self. I don't know. I hope that answers the question. Let's see. Looks like there's a conversation here about psychedelics. A lot of kind of crosstalk, people talking about what I'm saying as I'm saying it, which is awesome. Somebody's asking if I could talk about splitting, and I did. So hopefully that was helpful. Somebody else says Walter White is definitely a narcissist. I agree. Let's see. Okay. What are my thoughts on psychopathic personalities and their relation to pathological narcissism? I don't think that psychopathy is a type of pathological narcissism. I think that it's different in kind, not degree, from pathological narcissism. Pathological narcissism has to do with, feeling of self that's fragmenting and falling apart, and then the ways that we compensate for that. The fundamental thing about narcissists is that they are still interpersonally invested. They still, even if it doesn't feel like they need you, they absolutely need you. I've never worked with a narcissist who was not profoundly interpersonally dependent. And the well of dependency that sits underneath the grandiose false self presentation feels bottomless. And that's because it belongs to such a young self. And just think about how much little kids need, right? And so there's this self experience that sits at the center of narcissism that is incredibly dependent, and therefore incredibly invested in relationship, even if the external presentation is avoidant, right? That avoidance is based on the fear of rejection, okay, and of being hurt. Okay, so there's a vulnerability there, right? When we talk about narcissism, we talk about grandiosity, and we talk about vulnerability. Now, when we talk about psychopathy, we're not talking about vulnerability, and we're not talking about relational investment, okay? We're not talking about dependency. We're not talking about insecurity. What we're talking about is power and the pursuit of power via something called omnipotent control, which is considered to be an early or primitive psychological defense, where the person is trying to literally control other people. That is not so much a relational investment, that it belongs to a younger self, in other words. I think that psychopathic personalities, first of all, they can be influenced by measurable differences in the size of the amygdala. From a psychological perspective, I would see psychopathy as a different branch on the tree than narcissism. All right. Just got a couple minutes left. Let's see. Just want to share, there's a lady who recovered from NPD called Lisa Charlebois. We can do it. That name is incredibly familiar to me, and I'm not sure why. Ah, uh-huh. Okay, so I don't know if it's the same Lisa Charlebois, but somebody named Lisa Charlebois reached out to me about 9 years ago, when I first started to specialize in this kind of explicitly. So I first started to put it on my website and stuff like that. Somebody by that name reached out to me because she had written a book called You Might Be a Narcissist. If it's kind of like based on like the Jeff Foxworthy bit. And she said that she had all these people, you know, seeking help for narcissism, and she needed somewhere to refer them. She and I had a few phone conversations about it. And I don't know. I didn't hear from her since that time. So I don't know if she's since kind of come out as somebody who's recovered from NPD. But if so, you know, more power to her. And I'm glad to know that that there's somebody out there who's, you know, able to serve as a model for how that's possible. If it's the same person, I don't know if it's the same person, but it would be funny if it was. Not funny, haha, but just an interesting coincidence. Anyway, let's see. We're just about at the time here, and gosh, I'm so sorry if I didn't answer your question, but there's a lot of great questions here. I'm going to go through them, and I might end up making a video out of one or two of these. I guess, you know, the last thing I want to talk about before I end, I guess, you know, I just realized that I should probably talk about some of the services that I offer, you know, as a clinician. So I offer the following services. I offer individual psychotherapy, although currently my individual psychotherapy practice is full, but I do have a wait list and you can access that on my website. I also offer group psychotherapy, and that's a new service that I'm offering. I've got a group going, and I feel like it's going well. I feel like the group members are finding it helpful. And so I'm interested in expanding my group treatment options. So if you're interested in group therapy, please let me know. You can send me an email. There's a form on my website. Also, a benefit to group therapy is that it's cheaper than individual therapy. It's more affordable, and you get a peer experience. So you get to be supported by more than just me. And I think that the group members that are currently in my groups are finding that helpful as well. It helps with shame, embarrassment, humiliation, all those kind of like awful feelings that sit at the core, helps with that. So check that out. I also offer diagnostic assessments, and those are comprehensive services. There's somebody here who has been through that process. That's another thing that I provide. It's different. It's different than just like, I don't just meet with you once and diagnose. We meet, you know, for a period of a month or more. And at the end I generate a comprehensive report that, you know, it talks about personality styles and the presence of personality disorder and other issues that might be going on. And I really strive to do that from within an empathic and compassionate and developmentally informed perspective. Okay, so it's not just writing down a list of disorders. It's a narrative about how the person got where they are, with recommendations about what to do going forward. And I also offer consultations for family members and loved ones. Those are time limited, typically between 1 and 3 sessions, and I do reserve some times in my week for those. So if you'd like to consult, let me know. Again, all this is available on my website. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. I'm gonna do this more. This has been overwhelming to me, I'm so happy to know that so many people are interested in this, and happy to be helpful if I can. So thank you so much, everyone. I'm gonna go ahead and end the stream now, and look for this video on my YouTube channel, Heal NPD. Thanks again. Okay. Take care.